From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
He asked if any students plan to bring a date of another race to the prom. And when certain students raised their hand, you know, to acknowledge that they plan to bring a date of another race, he announced that if any interracial couples attended the prom, that he would cancel it.
An Alabama principal dismissed for racial insensitivity is sworn in a superintendent. Exit polls show Mexico's ruling party loses Mexico City for the first time in 7 decades. And was there prior government knowledge of the Oklahoma City bombing? All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Dealing a major blow to Mexico's ruling party, the opposition party's Cuauhtemoc Cardenas has won the Mexico City mayoral race in the first election there in 69 years. We'll have more on that after these headlines. In Northern Ireland, nationalist militants demanded IRA revenge yesterday after soldiers and police enabled Protestants to march through a hostile Catholic neighborhood, fending off rioters with muscle and plastic bullets. The march took all of 10 minutes, but it ignited rioting, carjackings, and gun attacks across Catholic areas of Northern Ireland. Police said a small homemade bomb exploded outside the wall of the heavily fortified New Barnsley police station in West Belfast early today. At the same time, a gunman fired at the police station and officers returned the fire. Nobody was hurt. The Irish Republican Army, meanwhile, claimed responsibility for the shooting of one policewoman in the face in Coleysland, northwest of Belfast. In this country, toxic heavy metals, chemicals, and radioactive wastes are being recycled as fertilizer and spread over farmers' fields nationwide. And there's no federal law requiring that they be listed as ingredients, this according to the Seattle Times. The issue came to light in the central Washington town of Quincy, population 4,000, when Mayor Patty Martin led an investigation by local farmers concerned about poor yields and sickly cattle. Until now, the Washington State Department of Agriculture sampled fertilizers only to see if they contained advertised levels of beneficial substances. The Seattle Times reports use of industrial waste as a fertilizer ingredient is a growing national phenomenon. In Gore, Oklahoma, a uranium processing plant gets rid of low-level radioactive waste by licensing it as a liquid fertilizer and spraying it over 9,000 acres of grazing land. At Camas, Washington, lead lace waste from a pulp mill is hauled to farms and spread over crops destined for livestock feed. In Moxie City, Washington, dark powder from two Oregon steel mills is poured from rail cars into silos at Bay Zinc Company under a federal hazardous waste storage permit. Then it's emptied from the silos for use as fertilizer. The newspaper called the powder a toxic byproduct of steelmaking, but did not identify it. Federal and state governments encourage the recycling, which saves money for industry and conserves space in hazardous waste landfills. The substances found in recycled fertilizers include cadmium, lead, arsenic, radioactive materials, and dioxins, this again according to The Times. The waste comes from incineration of medical and municipal waste and from heavy industries, including mining, smelting, cement kilns, and wood products. That is the Seattle Times of Washington. The chair of the Senate's campaign finance abuse hearing said yesterday the witness list may exceed the 200 already called to testify, but tread cautiously around the question of whether that might include President Clinton and Vice President Al Gore. The chair of the hearings is Senator Fred Thompson, the Republican of Tennessee. The hearings may last as long as the summer. Thompson earned his spurs as a Watergate counsel. His governmental affairs committee will look at a campaign finance system that is awash with unscrutinized money. But while both parties benefit from a donation system with few limits, key witnesses in the opening phase of hearings will be asked mostly about Democrats and China. And if any Democrats or Republicans that have been subpoenaed don't show up at the hearing, Thompson said he'll take legal action. One of Mexico's most powerful drug lords, Amada Carrillo Fuentes, died as a result of extensive plastic surgery intended to help him escape law enforcement. At least this is according to the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administrator Thomas Constantine. Constantine said his agents learned that Carrillo died early Friday morning at Santa Monica Hospital in Mexico City. The drug trafficker had checked in Thursday for a 9 to 10-hour plastic surgery, which Constantine described as a desperate attempt to escape pursuing law enforcement. Carrillo headed a drug cartel cartel centered in Juarez, Mexico, across the border from El Paso, Texas, that emerged in the past year as the most powerful of four cartels operating along the Mexican side of the border and smuggling drugs into the United States. He was a major player in the distribution of cocaine in the United States, again, according to the Drug Enforcement Administration. And the Sojourner rover became the first mobile vehicle to roam another planet yesterday, rolling onto the flowery Martian soil into a diverse landscape bearing unmistakable signs of ancient water activity, the basic requirement for life on any planet. Mission scientists treat the foot-high Sojourner, which has a 3D camera and an instrument designed to chemically analyze the Martian surface, as if it were alive. Just before four, as they woke the rover for its first full day of Martian soil, they played the theme of the television show Mad About You. And you're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Mexico's ruling Institutional Revolutionary Party, known as the PRI, suffered heavy defeats in national elections yesterday, the first time ever that the ruling party has allowed opposition parties to win major governmental posts up and down Mexico. The results are seen as an overwhelming rejection of President Ernesto Zedillo's tough economic austerity measures that have been strongly supported by Washington. At stake in yesterday's ballot was 500 seats in the Chamber of Deputies, the lower house of the Mexican Congress, and a quarter of the Senate's 128 seats. Hundreds of municipal offices were also up for grabs yesterday, including the mayor of Mexico City, which has been won by opposition leader Cuauhtemoc Cárdenas. Joining us now from Mexico City is Juan Gonzalez, co-host of Democracy Now! He's there covering the elections for the New York Daily News. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Juan.
Good day, Amy.
So what has the election day been like over the last 24 hours?
Well, last night it was pandemonium, especially here in Mexico City, largely because of the huge victory of Cuauhtemoc Cárdenas for the first ever election for a governor of the federal district, or what is equivalent to the mayor of Mexico City. Cárdenas got about 52% of the vote counted. Early this morning, when I finally went to bed, Cárdenas had 48% of the vote, compared to the PAN, the Conservative Party's 16%, and PRI's 25%. And interestingly enough, the Green Party came in fourth at about 7% of the vote in the federal district, and did pretty well across the country. And so it was a huge victory in Mexico City. And in the congressional races, there were about 500 seats up. The PRI did not make what they needed, would have been about 42% of the vote, because there's a complex system here of proportional representation of about 200 seats and direct election of about 300 seats. And so the PRI ended up with 36% of the vote, the PRD with 26, and the PAN with 28. So it was almost evenly split between the three parties in terms of the congressional races. So it was a huge basically return in popularity of the PRD, which had suffered back in 1994 presidential elections and been almost dismissed as a powerful force, and the PAN, which had been considered by many, especially in the U.S., the rising opposition party, also did not do nearly as well as most folks had expected. So you've got now Cárdenas clearly position to become the leading presidential candidate of the opposition in the elections for president in the year 2000.
Now, Juan, all the votes aren't counted, but the PRI would need 42% to maintain its majority in the chamber. If it fails, Zedillo would be the first Mexican leader since 1913 to face a Congress with a majority from opposition parties. What do you think that would mean for his economic policies?
Well, it would mean that for the first time, the PRI just couldn't do whatever it wanted to, especially when it comes to budgetary matters, since in Mexico, just as in the United States, the Congress, and especially the lower house, has the critical say over budgetary matters. So the PRI still controls the Senate, but it would not be, the PRI has been so used to in the last 68 years, virtually having the Congress rubber stamp whatever the centralized, the strong president model of government wants them to do, this would be the first time they would actually have to get themselves involved in negotiations. And there are suspicions that many PRI people on the left, because you remember Cardenas himself was a member of the PRI, was a governor of the state of Michoacán, so that there's a suspicion that other PRI defections will follow. And also there are suspicions that the right wing of the PRI will increasingly try to make alliances, as they have in the past, with BAN, the more conservative party. So you're going to be seeing a realignment of forces in the Mexican Congress, which at least is going to allow some degree of greater plurality and democracy. Still, a far cry from what we might even find in the United States or some other European countries, but at least a move away from this virtual single-party dictatorship that has existed for so long.
And did I hear you say that the Mexican Green Party had taken more than was expected votes?
It came in fourth, yes. There were eight parties in total, and it came in fourth in the federal district, and I think it did fairly well across the country, although we'll have to wait to see the final votes, because when you deal with percentages so small, you got to really wait to see what the total vote is.
We're talking to Juan Gonzalez, columnist with the New York Daily News, who's in Mexico City right now. And we're joined by John Ross, also in Mexico City, a freelance journalist and author of the forthcoming book, The Annexation of Mexico, From the Aztecs to the IMF, which is published by Common Courage. You also may know his book, Roots of Rebellion, Indian Uprising in Chiapas. Welcome to Democracy Now!, John.
How are you doing, Amy?
Good. You know, on Friday when Juan and I were talking just before the elections, I had asked him about where the Zapatistas fit into this election. You have written a very interesting book on the Zapatista uprising. How do you see them fitting in?
Well, it's a long story. I think everything's a long story around here. The victory of Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas last night is probably the middle of a very, very long journey. It began in July of 1987. I was fortunate enough to be there then, and I was there for much of the defeats and the occasional victories that have taken place over the last 10 years. And that crusade, I think, has been a very integral part of the development of a movement within the civil society here in Mexico that has also found its representation in the Zapatista Army of National Liberation. I can recall May 15th of 1994 in the jungle when Cárdenas first met Marcos. And although Marcos was very critical of the party, of the PRD, he and Cárdenas seemed to have hit it off from the very beginning. And just a couple of weeks ago over lunch with Cárdenas, I asked him if we might see in the near future, or at least in the future, Subcomandante Marcos here in Mexico City to celebrate the signing of the negotiated agreement. Cárdenas's response was, well, he could envision that, but it was really a question of what happens in the Congress of the country. Well, as of this morning, we have a tripartite Congress. I would disagree with Juan Gonzalez wholeheartedly in saying that we still have a long way to go to achieve the kind of democracy that exists north of the border. This country now has three very clear electoral options, and as far as I can see, there's only one in the United States of North America. So I think that needs to be said. On Wednesday, the Zapatistas, which was the day that the campaigns closed officially all over the country, the Zapatistas released their first communique in many months that were at least a communique that was directed at Mexican politics, saying that these past months had been the months of the parties, and the parties had shown all their faults. The Zapatistas are opposed to the parties. Appearances in indigenous communities. That's one of the points in the agreement that they had signed with the federal government that the Zedillo administration has refused to accept. And I think the new composition of the Congress, which makes this, which allows it this to be an opposition Congress, We'll go back and take a look at the CDO administration's refusal to deal with the accords that were signed in February of 1996 in San Andres, and we're going to see movement pretty soon on this. Yesterday in Chiapas, the situation turned very hot. The Zapatistas had asked their people not to vote. Some indigenous groups had decided they were going to vote. There seemed to have been a split somewhat in the organization, and a number of ballot boxes were burnt in the north of the state, in the jungle, and up in the highlands. A major confrontation, actually, probably the most major confrontation that occurred throughout the country. Again, an expression of the Zapatistas' dissatisfaction with the current political system and their desires to run their own communities in an autonomous mode without the parties interfering in those affairs.
That's John Ross, also speaking to us from Mexico City, who has written extensively about Mexico and has lived there for many years. Juan, would you care to amend what you said, or would you say you do disagree with John?
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that clearly that the political choices that exist for the Mexican peoples in terms of clarity of direction of these three major political parties and some of the minor political parties is a much greater menu of choices than exists for the American people. I think though that this is in terms of the reality of these choices is relatively new, since I mean the PRD really didn't get going until 1988, and at least the level of the stacked nature of the deck that the PRI had is less now. And I agree that in the United States we have fewer choices, but there is not the total control that exists. You've got the total control that exists of two parties. You have a monopoly of two parties rather than a monopoly of one has existed here for so long. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the Cardenas, Zapatista situation, it seemed to me, and I don't know because I wasn't here in 88 and certainly in 94 after the Zapatistas had arisen publicly, that Cardenas was consciously trying to distance himself from any repeatedly in the last few days when he was asked questions about what the Zapatista position was what his attitude would be to what would happen there in the future. He attempted to distance himself from that. And I think some of the people in his party have taken the position that in 94 he was hurt by the ability of the PRI to associate him with violence and popular disturbance and the Zapatista, or sympathy with the Zapatista uprising. And for some reason, there seems to have been a conscious decision on the part of some of the PRD leadership to distance him and make him more of a left-wing, non-violent opposition force, but clearly separated from any types of guerrilla movements.
John Ross, let me ask. I mean, in 1994, I went down to cover the Zapatista-Mexican government peace talks right after they rose up. And even at that time, Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas seemed to be distancing himself.
I think that was there is a history there. You can read the book, actually. There was a point in February when those talks took place, February of 1994, where there was friction between the PRD and the EZLN. That was, in fact, one of the first moments where both sides were defining their position. Cardenas, however, became the declared candidate and by May was campaigning throughout the country, and one of the places that he campaigned, actually, he was the only candidate to be allowed into the Zapatista zone to meet. And in fact, those pictures were, as Juan points out correctly, used against him during this current election, both in videotapes and in posters that were shown around town where Cardenas is. It has two sides to it. That photo was also used to stimulate a huge rally at the National University at the same time that it was used to try and dissipate voters as to Cardenas' proclivity for violence. The Zapatistas themselves have not been very violent for a long period of time.
John, we just have 10 seconds. I want to ask if you think the Zapatistas will become will join in electoral politics as we've seen in El Salvador and Guatemala.
No, I think not. I think that what we see is that the PRD is wholeheartedly into electoral politics, and this is an answer to the neoliberal threat that threatens all of Latin America.
On that note, I want to thank you very much for joining us, John Ross. His new book is called The Annexation of Mexico from the Aztecs to the IMF. It will be published by Common Courage Press. Juan Gonzalez with us, and will be back with us when he comes to New York, columnist with the New York Daily News. Both speaking to us from Mexico City. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Remember the Alabama high school principal who touched off a furor when he banned interracial couples from the prom? Hewlin Humphreys lost that job, but he was sworn in last week as superintendent of schools in Randolph County, Alabama. The Wadawi school system made headlines in 94 after he threatened to cancel the prom if mixed-race couples attended. The Justice Department later accused Humphreys of unfairness in dealing with black students. Subsequently, the school burned to the ground and Humphreys was removed as principal. Then last fall, he ran unopposed for county school superintendent and won. I spoke a few days ago to Charlotte Clark Friesen, who's president of the Randolph County NAACP and the first ever and only black member of the Board of Education. We tried to reach her right after Hewlin Humphreys was sworn in, but she is the head of a funeral home in the area, and she was buried in work. I asked Charlotte Clark Friesen to explain what happened in 1994.
Well, in 1994... During the month of February, Humphreys called an assembly of juniors and seniors, and he just made he made an inquiry. He asked if any students planned to bring a date of another race to the prom. And when certain students raised their hand, you know, to acknowledge that they planned to bring a date of another race, he announced that if any interracial couples attended the prom, that he would cancel it. And so that basically, you know, started the major controversy that blew up in 94. Well, there was this young girl who was, I think, a junior at that time, and her name was Ravonda Bowen. And she was the daughter of a white father and a black mother. And so Ravonda, quite naturally, when Mr. Humphreys made this announcement, Ravonda became very upset. And so she questioned Mr. Humphreys and said, well, who am I supposed to take to the prom? You know, and I guess because of the fact that she was biracial, you know, how could she not bring a date of another race? You know, and I could see her line of reasoning. And so his reply to her was that her mother and father had made a mistake by having her as a mixed child. So, you know, that is one of the things that blew this whole thing out. I mean, nobody could believe that he had said this publicly and in the presence of an entire class in an assembly that was called for that very purpose.
This all led to Humphreys being fired?
Okay, no. That's a whole nother story. But what it did do, it led to a lot of racial protests. It led to the involvement of several mainline civil rights organizations on the local level, such as the NAACP. In the beginning, the NAACP took up this fight. SCLC joined them, and then many other organizations, such as the ACLU, joined in the effort. And so there was just a massive protest going on. And basically, all of these organizations appealed to the local Board of Education to terminate Mr. Humphreys. And the Board of Education refused to terminate Mr. Humphreys. And so that led to further racial demonstrations and just a lot of outcry, a lot of overt stuff that went on during that time. And eventually, it even led to a boycott. So there were a lot of things that went on. And subsequently, then, what happened was the United States Justice Department filed a motion in federal court. And after this motion was filed, there were several months. I mean, I'm talking about nearly 2 years of mediation and negotiation. And the result, the end result then, was what we call a consent decree, which was basically like an agreement between the parties. And Hewlin Humphreys was a major part of that consent decree. But as a result of this consent decree, Mr. Humphreys was barred from going on campuses. There were certain other things that he was not to serve as a principal. He could not supervise. He could not serve in a position whereby teachers were being supervised or students were coming under his direct supervision, and so forth and so on. So as a result of this litigation that was actually filed by the United States Justice Department on May 17th, 1994, this is how Mr. Humphreys became a consultant to the Board of Education. He, as a matter of fact, I don't think the Board of Education itself, the local Board of Education, never willingly removed him as principal. They never agreed to do that because they basically sympathized with him and attempted to support him even throughout the controversy, even in the midst of tons of evidence against him.
But so who ultimately had him removed?
Well, ultimately, it was the decision of the court.
Now, you're on that Board of Education, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
The first ever and only African-American on that board.
That is right.
How long have you been there?
Since 1988.
So you've been in the midst of these discussions.
Oh, yes. I was in the midst of a lot of the controversy, as well as I witnessed a lot of other parent complaints that, centered on Mr. Humphreys' inability to relate well to blacks. Mr. Humphreys has never related well to black parents or black students. He seemed to resent anyone approaching him about any decision that he might have made regarding a student. If a black parent attempted to see him or discuss with him any action that he had taken towards a black student, Mr. Humphreys became very defensive and belligerent. And as a matter of fact, it's not only black parents who were dissatisfied. There's a white parent. Mr. Humphreys assaulted a white parent in his office. And so there were many, many grievances against him, over a period of years since desegregation in Randolph County. And he had a very well-known reputation for being a racist and for dealing with black students differently from the way that he dealt with white students, for being more harsh with black students and just being, an uneven disciplinarian where black students were concerned.
Now, Charlotte Clark Friesen, I did call Robert Bug, who is a close friend of Hewlin Humphreys and on the Board of Education. I also called the Board of Education President Romaine.
Right.
And asked them both if they would participate in this conversation. Mr. Romaine hung up on me, and Mr. Bug said the case is closed and then hung up on me.
What? Well, see, that's typical. That's very typical. I don't doubt it one bit. I don't doubt one bit that they did that, because their whole response throughout this whole thing has been to run away from it.
We also called Hewlin Humphreys today, and his wife said that while he would be willing to speak about education, he was not willing to speak about this controversy.
Mm-hmm. No, he is not. He certainly is not. And that's been, I think that's been one of our whole problems throughout this whole thing, is because none of them will admit that we have a problem. None of them will admit that that Hewlin Humphreys has been the center of a lot of racial tension and a lot of discord in this particular school system. No one wants to deal with that issue.
Now, I don't understand something. If he, by the decree of the court, had to give up the principalship of the school and, as a consultant, was not allowed on the property when there were students there, had to go to the school before and after school and consulting on the new school building, how can he be superintendent? I assume he would have to have contact with students.
Well, to be absolutely honest with you, that is really our question, and that was one of the reasons why we filed other motions in court. We filed other motions on the basis that, first of all, even after a federal court judge ordered him not to go on school property, by the way, the federal judge was Myron Thompson, who also is black, Hewlin Humphreys disregarded that order and did go on campus. And so we filed a motion on the basis that he had violated a consent decree on a federal judge's court order, and went right ahead on and went on school property when students were present. We felt that by virtue of this, he should be disqualified. He should not have been allowed to even qualify as a candidate. And another basis on which we filed this motion was that he did not qualify according to Alabama law because he was no longer a supervisor. He was not in a supervisory position. There were express orders in the court decree which specified that Humphreys could not supervise teachers or students. Yet the law in Alabama says that a person who's qualifying to run for superintendent of school has to be in a supervisory position.
Is it possible that the federal court will annul this election?
We wish that they would, and this is what we asked them to do, but I don't believe that Judge Myron Thompson is going to do it. He certainly did rule in our favor in that he ruled that Humphreys most certainly did violate the consent decree, but he said that he was not going to prevent him from being superintendent.
So what does this mean for the black community right now? What are your plans come the fall?
Well, to be absolutely honest, I hate to be the one to say this, but I personally feel that in the best interest of black students in Randolph County, the children are going to have to flee from the public schools in this county and not participate and find an alternative means of educating, of providing education. It has been, I guess, implied to a degree that the students might exit the school systems again by way of the Freedom Schools. You know, we established Freedom Schools back in 94 during the boycott, and it was a very difficult time. By no means am I advocating that, you know, boycotting is the best thing to do, but sometimes it's the only thing to do.
Was this the boycott in reaction to Hewlin Humphreys' first comments in 94?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Who would teach the students in the Freedom Schools?
Well, back in 94, we just took volunteers, anyone who was available and willing and, you know, who had the time to work with the children. They worked with them, and the Freedom Schools were conducted in three churches in the county. This time, I would certainly think that it would need to be much better organized and, of course, much better qualified personnel, you know, but when we get into the issue of trying to provide education for kids, you know, it's a touchy subject. It's a real complicated issue because, number one, you know, public school is really the place where the children should be educated. It doesn't seem fair that they should have to flee from a system where they pay taxes. And they're entitled, you know, they are entitled to public education, and it should be free. It should be appropriate. It should be non-threatening, you know.
What percentage of the public schools are black children?
I'd say roughly 40%, 38 to 40%.
How many black families do you think would participate in the Freedom Schools, pull their kids from the public school come fall?
At this time, I really have no idea. Mm-hmm. I just don't know. I would hope that a majority of parents would participate. But because of the fact that we're looking at, you know, I mean, it's going to be a long, hard row to hoe, you know, and a lot of parents are just not up to it. So, you know, it's going to take a lot of committed people to really, you know, stay with it. And, I mean, we've been fighting this thing since 1994 and really before that. You know, so it's going to take, would take some very strong parents and some determined, committed parents.
Charlotte Clark Bryson, does it absolutely break down along racial lines, or are there some white families who would also pull their kids out or who have protested?
Well, to be honest, I feel that there are white parents who have already pulled their kids out. They pull their kids out when they realize what kind of system we were dealing with here. A lot of them are not going to speak out about it, though. That is the very sad thing. That is, to me, that's the most, you know, that's the most devastating part of this whole thing, that the white parents who did choose to move their children out of the system, they were not, they would not speak out and let it be known that this was the reason why they were doing it. You know, there are a lot of parents who are in sympathy with what black parents and students are going through, but they just either they're afraid or intimidated or whatever, but for whatever reasons will not speak out about it.
Finally, you have been on the Board of Education as the only African-American.
Yes.
What is their reaction to you, the other board members? How many other board members are there?
Well, there is a seven-member board, and I am one-seventh of that board. I am one of seven members. I think that I've always been a thorn in the side of the school board members. But in particular, the last since June of 1995, I have not attended a school board meeting. I have, I guess, sort of been passively protesting because, like I said, this board has been totally sympathetic to Hewlett Humphreys with no regard, no concern whatsoever for the other students and parents and their concerns. They have been reckless in spending school funds. They led our school system into a state of financial ruin because of legal fees incurred trying to defend themselves for retaining Hewlett Humphreys even after he made the racist remarks. So I have basically been a thorn in their sides up until, you know, the time that I attended my last board meeting. So basically, you know, I think they're still acting recklessly and you know, without regard to what really ought to be our priorities in the system. You know, I think our priorities ought to be about settling these racial problems, finding a way to sit down to the table together and work it out, you know, work with the community and appeal to the community for their help.
You mentioned that there have been many other problems. What about the ratio of black teachers to white teachers? You say that there's a 40% black student population. How about the teachers?
I would imagine there's probably less than 1% of teaching staff in the county.
How have you addressed that?
Well, that was also addressed in this consent decree that came out of all this controversy that arose back in 1994. Mm-hmm. The school system did agree to change its hiring practices. But to be absolutely honest, there has not been very much change along the lines of, you know, as far as hiring more black personnel, more black administrators, et cetera.
You're also the head of the NAACP of Randolph County.
You're right.
And the NAACP has just announced that at their annual meeting this month, they're going to have a debate about whether integration of the schools, whether desegregation is actually the best way to go. What are your thoughts on that?
I realize that the NAACP fought harder than probably any other organization for desegregation. But in many ways, desegregation hurt black children. It hurt black parents. It hurt black professionals because black professionals became like endangered species. Black administrators, you know, they became like rare. Children were not seeing as many black role models as they really needed to see in the public schools. So, yes, our children were hurt. And to be absolutely honest, I don't know if integration has really done, it has not really accomplished much of what it should have accomplished or what we wish it had accomplished.
Charlotte Clark Friesen, president of the Randolph County NAACP, the first ever and only black member of the Board of Education of Randolph County, speaking to us from Randolph County in Alabama. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. We'll be back in 60 seconds. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. You know, tomorrow, starting on Democracy Now!, we'll be talking about the campaign finance abuse hearings that'll be taking place, led by the Government Affairs Committee, headed by Republican Senator Fred Thompson. Democracy Now! Will be there every day, all day, that those hearings take place. They're expected to take place this week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and the following weeks, about that kind of schedule. So we'll keep you up to date on what's happening and do some investigation behind the scenes. But right now, we're going to go out to Oklahoma. Last week in Oklahoma City, a grand jury was impaneled to investigate allegations that more people were involved in the April 19th, 1995 bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building than just convicted bomber Timothy McVeigh and his alleged co-conspirator, Terry Nichols. Led by Oklahoma State Representative Charles Key and Glenn Wilburn, an accountant who lost two grandsons in the bombing, volunteers gathered more than 13,000 signatures to force the grand jury review. We're joined now by J.D. Cash, a journalist who's been actively campaigning for the new grand jury investigation. He's with the McCurtain Gazette in Idabel, Oklahoma, which is in southeastern Oklahoma. We're also joined in Washington by Jim Ridgway, who covers the far right for the Village Voice, a weekly newspaper based in New York City. He's the author of Blood in the Face, a book on the far right, which was published by Thunder's Mouth Press. Well, J.D. Cash, why don't you start us off by talking about what this effort was that went into impaneling the grand jury?
Well, Amy, this was a two-year battle that was fought principally by Glenn Wilburn and Charles Key. They decided a few months after the bombing that they had spoken with too many witnesses who had told them basically the same thing, that Mr. McVeigh was involved with other persons, not only in the planning stages of the bombing, but also in the execution of it. In fact, one of those key witnesses, Mr. Gary Lewis, was an employee who was standing outside of the Journal Record building, just some 200 feet from the Murrah building that morning, smoking his pipe on a break when he was nearly run over by Mr. McVeigh and another individual leaving the parking lot in the Yellow Mercury. And so what they decided to do, since they didn't feel that the U.S. Attorney's Office, after they handed down after the federal grand jury handed down their limited indictments of only two persons, McVeigh and Nichols and others unknown, that they could trust them to go forward with it. And I think clearly they were right. There seems to be a real reluctance on the part of the federal establishment to go after the others that were clearly involved. And so finally they filed application in district court for a citizen's grand jury. At that time they filed it, they would have only needed under state law 500 signatures. Mr. Macy, the county attorney for Oklahoma County, took them to court and fought the application. The district judge had initially turned down that application, but Macy was the one who took them to court over it. And eventually they had to take the thing all the way through the Oklahoma State Supreme Court. It was about a two-year fight. And all the way along this battle that they're going through, Macy, the county attorney, is the guy who's fighting them. Well, eventually the Supreme Court rules in their favor and says, of course, they have the right to take up signatures. That's the state law. And by the time this ruling came down, the state law had changed to where they were required to get 5,000 signatures. Also in the meantime, Mr. Wilburn was diagnosed and was operated on for pancreatic surgery. And so he was largely left outside of this the fight. And Mr. Key, to his credit, was able to put together some volunteers, and not only did they get the signatures required, but they got 2.5 times, almost 3 times the signatures required, because in Oklahoma County, the citizens there have heard enough information to realize that there's much, much more to the Oklahoma City bombing than what one would pick up from listening to the government's theory of the case.
Jim Ridgway, you've been covering the right in this country for a long time for the Village Voice. Do you think this is just another conspiracy theory, or a theory that's grounded in reality?
Oh no, I don't think it's a conspiracy theory at all. I think J.D.'s absolutely correct. I mean, you have to realize that since 1983, elements, you know, groupings of the so-called far right, the racialist right, have been on, have plotted to blow up the Murrah building. I mean, this is nothing, you know, new. This has been going on since.
Jim, we're having a little trouble with your voice, so we're going to ask if we can get you on the telephone, and we're going to go back to J.D. Cash for just a minute. Jim Ridgway of the Village Voice, you heard him echoing there. Sometimes our ISDN system doesn't work quite the way it should work. And J.D. Cash with us from the McCurtain Gazette in Oklahoma. Explain a little more about the idea, J.D. Cash, of prior government knowledge, which, of course, is the most explosive thought of all here.
And clearly it's the one that has the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Justice Department in a fit. They are sitting on dynamite. They have the information. They clearly know that there was a sting operation in place to catch these individuals in Oklahoma City before they bombed the building. There was the ATF had a group brought in from out of state, specially trained group. They were working in conjunction with the State Highway Patrol Bomb Squad, the Oklahoma County Bomb Squad, and there are so many witnesses who saw the bomb squad clearly rigged out in their outfits that morning outside not only the Murrah building, but also the Internal Revenue Service building, which was an alternate target of this group, that morning up until 8 a.m. At 8 a.m., they disappeared from the scene. The information that we've consistently received was that they believed that the bombing was to occur sometime in the wee hours of the morning when the building was vacant. The information that they received from their informant was the operation had been called off for that night but would proceed on the next night, which was Hitler's birthday. And so they fell back to their command post. And the next thing we know is apparently there's a double cross, and McVeigh, with one other individual in the truck, pulls up in front of the building. There are two fuses. McVeigh lights the first fuse, which is a four-minute fuse, exits and travels to the northwest where there's another individual waiting in the yellow Mercury, and they speed away. The last individual, which Dana Bradley talks about, lit the two-minute fuse, exited a little bit to the north and east, got into a pickup truck with two other individuals, and sped away just moments before the blast. And the state law enforcement people that I have been fortunate enough to get some good information from have consistently told me that McVeigh was involved with at least four other individuals and possibly a fifth in downtown. And then we, of course, have the issue of who built the bomb. Clearly, McVeigh was not in the area of Kansas during the time that witnesses say they saw this second truck, this other yellow moving van at Gary Lake on the 10th, 11th, and 12th. with two men coming and going regularly from the back of that truck. They had a brown pickup truck and a white Mercury there, and they were there for 3 days. Obviously, and that is the scene where the FBI later said that they found residues of bomb-making material. And so what you have, and the apparent reason that the feds don't want to go any further in this conspiracy is out of fear that they will expose their informant. And in the process, of course, expose the fact that they had a sting operation that went bad that eventually cost the lives of 168 persons.
Jim Ridgway of the Village Voice, let me ask you again, what do you make of this?
Well, number one, I don't think you can argue about the details. Many people would argue with what J.D. said, but some of the details. But the fact is that since 1983, elements or groups on the far right, that is the racialist right, have had an underground in place. It's been well documented and followed. And since 1983, since the death of Gordon Call, who was one of the sort of martyrs of this movement, there have been plans and plots, very detailed plots, to blow up the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City. So you can't really just say that, you know, this all just happened out of off the wall, so to speak. I mean, it has a history. And not only does it have a history, but the people who participated in that plot are very much alive. One of them, Jim Ellison, lives in Elohim City, which is a Christian Identity compound in eastern Oklahoma, which has also been the center of a lot of activity in terms of bank robberies, that is, racialist bank robberies and other kinds of activity. Another person, Kerry Noble, who participated in that plot, gave me and has given J.D. and other people interviews and described in some detail the way in which in 1983, Ellison and himself and a man named Snell, who's since been executed for murder, went down to Oklahoma City and cased the Murrah Building and looked at it and decided how to blow it up. And in fact, there was the plot to blow it up. The man who was making the rockets, which were going to be used to blow it up, had a rocket blow up in his hands. And the only reason they didn't blow it up at that point was because this man, the technical man who was to make the munitions, you know, was taken out of action. So this has been discussed in some length and in many different ways and by many different people over a period of time. That's just one very good reason to inquire into the people who may very well have been interested in this, in doing in the Murrah Building.
You know, it's interesting. Today, McVeigh's attorneys have come forward and appealed. This is the last day, I think, that they could appeal the verdict and call for a new trial. And they're appealing it on the grounds, among other things, that they weren't able to bring in the information about corruption in the FBI crime lab.
Well, I mean, they also weren't able to bring on Carol Howe, who is J.D. is the one who brought to light the existence of Carol Howe, and he can tell you more about her. But, I mean, basically, she's a former Tulsa debutante, I guess is how she's described, who took a walk on the wild side and got in with the neo-Nazi movement and then also worked as an informant for the ATF. And she filed reports from her activities, and she was at Elohim City in 1994 and I guess into 1995, and she described discussions there of blowing up these federal buildings, including the Murrah Building. And so Jones wanted to bring her on in the trial as a witness, and the judge, I guess, ruled that she was irrelevant to the trial, so she was sent home. But she almost surely would be called in a grand jury investigation or in a state murder case. And one of the most interesting things that happened here in Washington was that Senator Specter set up a series of hearings, or at least one hearing, a week or so ago, and he was to have Jones, McVeigh's defense attorney, and Carol Howe come and testify onto some of the other the theories that were swimming around the Oklahoma City thing, and his hearing was suddenly called off. And according to one of the participants I talked to, it was called off at the instance of the Justice Department. Because the Justice Department said that if Specter was to have his hearing, then it would prejudice the prosecution of the Nichols case. So, I mean, to say that this is just a conspiracy theory or something just begs the fact that there's an awful lot of discussion at all levels of the government and the citizenry about who else was involved in this bombing.
J.D. Cash, I've been looking at some of your articles in the McCurtain Daily Gazette in Idabel, Oklahoma, particularly the ones you've written in the last week about one Reverend Robert Miller. Can you talk about this spiritual leader of Elohim City?
Well, that was sort of a surprise even to me. And at this point, Amy, very few things surprise me. But in the process of leading up to after, let me back up just for a second. After the information on Carol Howe came to light and I wrote the story, the government went out and indicted her. It's one of the most tragic things that I have seen in this whole series of tragic events. And so in preparation for her to go to trial, her attorney in a pretrial hearing the other day put an FBI agent on the stand from Tulsa and started asking him questions, and one of the questions was, is Reverend Millar of Elohim City a source of information to the Bureau? And after a bit, he finally stammered out and admitted that, yes, Millar is an informant or a source for the FBI and has been for quite some time. And so what we have found is not only was Carol Howe working under contract and as a paid informant at Elohim City for the ATF, we have Millar providing information from the FBI, and then we still have the other figure, which we don't have time to get into, but a German by the name of Andreas Strassmeier, who came over here with an intelligence background from Germany. His father is a former state secretary to Berlin, and he infiltrated Elohim City, presumably for a different law enforcement group, possibly even the CIA, and was providing information on the goings-on there. And it's interesting that Carol Howe, in her reports to the ATF, says that Strassmeier is the ringleader who is promoting the illegal acts at Elohim City, including the bombing of federal buildings.
And what's the proof that Strassmeier is connected to one of the enforcement agencies?
Well, there is another area which will come up in the appeals that McVeigh has filed, in that they had sent out questionnaires to various law enforcement groups asking, is Strassmeier yours? All of the groups, except for the CIA, responded negative, and the CIA said that we've sent our response to Beth Wilkerson, the special U.S. attorney on the prosecution team. So when Jones, after sending two letters to, and this is going on actually while the trial's in process, sends two letters to Wilkerson, she does not respond. He goes to Judge Maitch. Maitch never did require Wilkerson to turn over that information. What we do know is that Strassmeier applied not only to the DEA for a law enforcement position undercover, but also applied to the FBI. And at some point, he got on with someone. He was never interviewed after the bombing for 14 months while he remained in this country, in spite of the fact that he had been named as a suspect and had actually been listed by the FBI as someone that they wanted to arrest as a suspect in the Oklahoma City bombing. All of these things come out, but Strassmeier never does anything. He's never interviewed in this country. And only when our newspaper got on his trail and McVeigh's team started asking questions about him did he go back to Germany.
J.D. Cash, do you think that McVeigh should have been convicted?
I think that he has a role in this, but we'd also, as Oklahomans, would like to see all of those persons who have a role in this brought to justice.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us, J.D. Cash, who is a reporter with the McCurtain Daily Gazette in Idabel, Oklahoma. You can go to a search engine on your website and see if you can find some of his articles. And we've been talking to Jim Ridgway of the Village Voice, based in New York City. You can also go to the web to find his articles in the Village Voice. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland is our New York engineer. Andy York is our Washington engineer. Julie Drizin, our executive producer. You can call us at 1-202-588-0999, extension 313, or write to us by email at democracy@pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!